Today, let's talk housing crashes. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to the latest post covering finance and property news with a distinctively Australian flavour. And I'm joined today again by journalist Tarek Brooker. Hi, Tarek.
G'day, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, pretty good. A big week of data this week.
Oh, it certainly has been. Some big surprises and some not so big surprises, I suppose.
Yeah, I assume that you are referring to the employment statistics, or more precisely, the unemployment statistics and the funny numbers in there, which we might touch on. But also, of course, all of the switcheroos that are going on amongst the bank economists, all now claiming that there's no housing fall, houses are going to go up next year.
Yeah, there's certainly plenty to unpack in that respect, isn't there? Like, everything is all of a sudden just completely flipped. And I mean, I'm not going to start implying any conspiracy theories or anything, but I do think it's awfully convenient that everything suddenly becomes so bullish. Just, less than 2 weeks before we're going to start to see all of this various support mechanisms come to an end.
Yeah, well, as we've discussed before, of course, we're in that sort of calm before the storm. We know that the stimulus is being removed. But it's in the bank's interests, of course, isn't it, to maintain this view of strong house prices, because it means they don't have to revalue the assets and all of those things. And, of course, the government will be plotting and planning for its budget down the track. And I guess they can argue that with unemployment now dropping, then, the work's done.
Yeah, it certainly looks that way. And I think even if we just look at everything with Australia from a more international perspective, I mean, we're one of the only countries in the Anglosphere that actually has falling housing prices. You know, you look at New Zealand, you look at Canada, the UK, the US, they've all got booming housing markets for reasons that people don't fully understand. And yet little old Australia, who's meant to, where housing prices are meant to double every 7 years, we're seeing housing price falls. And that's really quite interesting, especially with the difference in the data between the Australian Bureau of Statistics and CoreLogic for the June quarter.
Well, it is interesting, although it's also fascinating. I was giving a presentation yesterday to some investment bankers, and they were predicated on the view that there's no housing price fall at all, I guess believing the more recent data, and that everything was going to go up. Right. And so I had to sort of dissect that a little bit. And it is fascinating that in New Zealand, they've got booming house prices there. And look, let's understand that one of the levers, of course, is lower interest rates. Right. Because essentially, if rates come down, in theory, people then can afford to pay back even bigger loans. Although in practice, if you look at the underwriting standards here in Australia, they're now tighter than they were a little while before. So that probably goes against that. And we are now at the point where interest rates are really as low as they're going to go. So whatever impetus that led in terms of over the past history to higher prices, that's done now. So it's weird. I think I can't quite figure out why it is, if you really look at the data, as to why people would have an expectation that prices are going to rise, given that we are still not yet out of stimulus, remembering that the stimulus has been withdrawn. It's going to be withdrawn over the next two or three quarters. You know, JobSeeker, JobKeeper, the super withdrawals are pretty much stopped now. And, of course, the banks are knocking on people's doors.
No, I find it really quite fascinating to watch people look at today's data, which is heavily, heavily distorted by various stimulus measures, by eviction moratoriums, by insolvency moratoriums, and then take that data and then extrapolate it for a year or 2 years or 3 years down the road to say, okay, this is what's going to happen based on the current trajectory. But that's not really where we're going, because all this stimulus isn't going to continue in the economy. We're not going to keep it. I mean, what did UBS say? $105 billion in total support measures every quarter from now until forever. That's going to be tapered down to zero. And I think that that's really quite interesting, just in terms of the fact that the differences between some of the bank economists and even some of the investment bank economists, the AMPs, the Shane Olivers, there's quite a very, very wide range views now, especially if you include people, say, like Louis Christopher from SQM, who's now talking, you know, he's been talking about a potential, and I clarify, potential 30% price fall for quite some time now. And I think that's really interesting because on one hand, I read the other day, CBA's like, okay, Q3 is looking a little bit dodgy because of the Victorian lockdown, but we're going to see almost 3% growth in Q4. And then I listened to Alan Oster's podcast the other day, who's the chief economist of NAB, and he's saying, no, Q3 is going to be weak. He agrees with CBA on that, but Q4 is going to be negative. So, I mean, there's a very, very big difference between 3% quarter-on-quarter growth and basically, you know, the continued downward trajectory of the economy, which is, no, I mean, really, four quarters of negative growth is basically just like a mini depression.
Well, look, I think the answer is that nobody really quite knows, right? Because the data is very, very patchy. And of course, a lot of the statistical information from the ABS is distorted because of JobKeeper. So JobKeeper respondents are actually not registered as unemployed. And it's also worth reflecting, I think, on the fact that that unemployment data includes a lot of gig jobs, right? So, you know, you only have to be employed for an hour to be employed, and therefore they, if you look at the hours worked and the number, you know, numbers of jobs, the two didn't seem to move together, which suggests to me that this is not as anywhere near as strong as perhaps people were, you know, reacting to. And then the other point, of course, is that what's going to happen the other side of the budget is completely unknown, right? I mean, people will have various views as to what the government will or won't do, I suppose. But again, there's quite a wide avenue of different options that they have. Will they extend JobKeeper, JobSeeker? Will they not? Will they do additional sort of targeted support mechanisms? You know, will they support the university sector? Will they support small businesses? You know, what are they going to do? So there are so many variables. That's why I talk scenarios. I think you have to talk scenarios rather than actually trying to be definitive.
Oh, definitely. I mean, considering what could come in the budget, which I believe is on October 6th, that, you know, it could be any number of different things. And trying to predict anything with a single number, to me, is just, realistically, it's quite foolhardy, to be completely honest with you. I think it's impossible at this point. You know, there's too many different things that the government could pull out of their hats. And, I mean, perhaps after the budget, we should do a little bit of a show and unpack all the various things in October. But going back to the unemployment statistics for a moment, yesterday the unemployment statistics for Canada came out from ADP, and they said in July that there was over 1.1 million jobs created. And then when they released this month's figures, they said, oh, whoops, it wasn't 1.1 million jobs created. It was 523,000 jobs lost. So there was a 1.6 million job deficit and difference between the Canadian unemployment figures. And that's absolutely enormous. I mean, Canada is a bigger country than Australia, roughly, what, twice the population or thereabouts. I mean, that's like, you know, going, whoops, we thought we created 800,000 jobs, but we didn't. Sorry about that. So it really does, you know, indicate that there is a lot of pressure and a lot of different distortions going on in the labor market, and especially in terms of the collection of data. And we're seeing the same thing in the US. You know, you ask in terms of the number of people collecting unemployment benefits, it's 29.7 million. If you ask in terms of the non-farm payroll survey report, it's a lot less than half that. So there are a lot of distortions there. And I think that that's why it's so difficult to make any determination based on just one figure. And that's really rammed home, I think, with this ABS report, because I went through the JobKeeper data recently that Treasury released, and between the end of July, so the start of August, and the 5th of September, approximately 208,000 more people are having their jobs protected by JobKeeper, are being supported by JobKeeper. And I can't really reconcile the two numbers. On one hand, 111,000 people got their jobs back, apparently, in August. And on the other hand, 208,000 people, a large portion of whom are from Victoria, are now suddenly at risk of losing their jobs, and that their businesses felt like they needed to, you know, apply for the payment. So it's really quite difficult. And then, of course, there's the Roy Morgan report, which says the unemployment rose as well. So a lot of different views to unpack there.
Yeah, and you know, nobody quite knows, I think, which is right. And you know, the fact that other countries around the world are having the same issues with trying to triangulate all the data points with all of these protections that are in place. And, you know, when is a job not a job? And, you know, do you count an hour? Do you not count an hour? I mean, in a way, I think you've just got to let it all settle down. My own read on the situation based on my surveys is that the jobs are still pretty weak. There are many people working many less hours than previously who would actually, by the way, still be classed as employed. And I think probably the hours worked numbers are a better guide rather than actually the unemployment numbers. And of course, the jobs, the hours worked numbers really hardly moved at all, right? In fact, they went down in Victoria and up elsewhere, and it was sort of pretty much a line ball. So there might have been some redistribution in terms of hours worked. But I can tell you from my surveys that there are many, many people who are still receiving less hours and less income than previously, which is why the stress levels are still so high.
Yeah, well, it's also the data from the Department of Social Services as well, which is also showing a very different story. I mean, if you could pull the graph up that I sent you earlier today, it shows that basically what I did is I went through their data and I stripped out the people who are not job seekers. I've only got that data back to February, so it's implied that everyone who's lost their job afterwards is a job seeker. So I just put that little addendum in there before we proceed. But it shows basically that it's no longer representative. The number of people collecting Centrelink is no longer representative of the ABS figures at all. They're completely detached. Yep. The ratio between the number of people claiming Centrelink and the number of people that the ABS reports as unemployed has more or less doubled. So, I mean, if you extrapolate that ratio out, I mean, you're talking an enormous number of people who would be formally unemployed through, you know, through the ABS statistics. But I think that it's really, really quite complicated. And I think it has been for some time in terms of the labour market statistics. Like, if you look at the issues that they've had in the UK, in the US, they've had issues with the number of people responding to the survey. And I mean, I can only speak for myself. I won't speak for anyone else. But if I was really struggling and having a really bad time, the last thing I would want to do is have a conversation with the ABS about losing my job. And I think, and I do wonder if 30 years without a recession has sort of made Australians just a little bit proud, a little bit prideful that we don't want to talk about the bad things that are happening to us. Because that doesn't happen in Australia. Only good things happen in Australia. And all my mates are buying boats and new cars and Taranas and all sorts of stuff. So things must be good for me too, even though they're not.
Yeah, well, there's certainly a psychological aspect to it. And, you know, the sampling that the ABS now uses is relatively small. And I've always had some suspicions about the volatility in the numbers at the best of times. So, you know, I don't hold too much weight to them. I think actually the Roy Morgan approach probably gives a better sounding as to what's really going on. And the reason I guess this is so important, and just to, you know, come back to our housing crash starting point, is if there are more people unemployed, they won't be able to pay their mortgages. If they won't be able to pay their mortgages, then there are going to be things like forced sales and restructurings going on, and that's going to be a significant dampener on the housing sector ahead, right? And that is why the housing crash or the housing adjustments follow directly from what's happening to unemployment. If unemployment really is correcting, and it's going to be quicker than what the Reserve Bank said. Remember, they said 10% and then 7% 2 years later. If it is actually better than that, then the chances are that the impact on the housing market will be less severe. But I just come back to the US data, which showed that after the global financial crisis in 2008, it took 3 to 4 years for the unemployment really to grind through, for the default rates to rise and forced sales and therefore the house prices to fall. So to my mind, you have to be looking over a 4 to 5 year period, and you've got to take account of the fact that these things always grind more slowly than you might hope for.
No, absolutely. I mean, you look at the data for Ireland, the data for the US, even the data for Spain, they're all very similar. As you say, it's something that happens over a period of time. There's the slow grind down. And, you know, I see these housing spruikers with, and sometimes I watch your videos and there'll be a housing spruiker ad saying, property prices haven't crashed, ergo they're not going to crash and you should go buy now. And I get those ads all the time. They drive me nuts. But it's just a bit ridiculous, to be honest, because we're talking about extrapolating out a scenario at the moment with all this stimulus, with all this support. And I keep saying to people, the recession hasn't been allowed to start yet. how many recessions have there been in history where people get paid to not work? How many recessions have there been in history when households have roughly 16% more income in their pockets than they did before? You know, where people are not allowed to go bust, where businesses aren't allowed to go bust, where people don't have to pay their mortgages. There isn't a single recession in history where any of those things has happened on a meaningful level. So it really hasn't happened yet. So, I mean, even so, recently I did a little comparison between the Case-Shiller housing price index in the US and Sydney and Melbourne. And Melbourne is falling faster than housing prices were in the US when they were crashing. So I base that off when Melbourne prices peaked versus the start of the Great Recession in the US, and housing prices are falling quicker. And like I said, the recession hasn't even started yet. And it just makes me wonder what's going to happen when it does. And I think one of the key things, and this is something that we've spoken about before, is just the confidence level of Australians. Like, I look at these numbers, and while they don't get me wrong, they're not fantastic and they're not great by any stretch of the imagination, they're nowhere near as dire as some of the numbers coming out of the UK or the US, where consumers are far more dour about their prospects. I mean, the Westpac Melbourne Institute numbers, they're higher now than they were in January. To me, that is nuts. You know, I mean, we got 1.3 million people who are going to lose access to JobKeeper in less than 2 weeks' time. And our confidence level is higher than it was in January, before there was even a crisis.
Hmm. And some of that, again, is psychological. You know, here in Australia, we always take the sunny side of the street and things will be right. And in some cases, I think there's also a degree of ignorance, if I can be frank about this. You know, there are many people who really don't know what their overall financial position is. They don't understand what's going on more broadly. They hear the high-level headlines, you know, oh, everything's fine, house prices are up, and they see all of these examples of people who's still making money on property and all those things, you know, and the property shows are still running. So in a way, there is this sort of phony war going on, right? And you know, everything is perfectly fine, and okay, I can hear that bit of noise in the background, but there's no real evidence. And then of course the government's given them money, and so the government basically has given them money, and they're spending it on all sorts of weird things, and high powered cars and those sorts of things are all up at the moment. But it's like sort of, yeah, but hang on, you know, there's a bigger context here that we need to understand. And I just come back to that cliff that we keep talking about, right? I mean, that cliff is real, right? Whatever the government's going to do in the budget, it's not going to be sufficient to reverse the loss. And it's interesting, did you see the alpha beta chart that showed actually how much more money was in the circulation now, right? And the biggest by far, was it 19 billion, was actually to do with the superannuation withdrawals, right? That's the biggest chunk. And then JobKeeper and JobSeeker, about seven each, I think. And the other thing, the CBA numbers came out today and showed how much additional money has flowed in from the government into people's accounts in recent times. It's a massive amount, right? But again, that's beginning to ebb away again now. So we are in this weird hiccup situation, right? But I suspect the hiccup's just around the corner. And when it hits, well, that's when we really get into serious territory.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I reckon you should put up that CBA chart, because it is absolutely shocking. Yeah. You know, you look at it and you think, oh my God. I mean, in a way, I feel like we should be flipping it upside down. You know, that should be the income loss that we should be seeing in the recession, not the income increase. And that's really, I mean, in fairness to people, you know, the average person in Australia, they don't watch DFA, they don't watch AusBiz. They don't read Macro Business. They don't read any number of these other sort of independent financial media outlets. They watch commercial television. They read mainstream news websites, if they read news websites at all, you know, depending on the individual, naturally. And I don't really blame them for looking at things the way that they do. You know, they look at things and they're like, well, things are pretty good. Mm. And I mean, the way I see it is rather simple, very black and white for the average person. I think they go down the shops, they talk to their friends, and that is the barometer of the economy. You know, if people go down the local shopping center and stuff is flying off the shelves and people are all having a good time in the food court, as far as they're concerned, the economy is doing well. As long as they've got a job and they've got money flowing in, you know, things are pretty hunky dory. And I mean, that's the way everyday people approach things. I mean, it's not uncommon for people to be disengaged with politics or the financial or financial things or economic things. It's perfectly normal. I mean, I read a survey the other day that said that 20% of people didn't know what the Prime Minister's name was, you know, so expecting them to understand things like, you know, PMIs or services indexes and, you know, how much that above 50, you know, it represents growth and how much it represents, you know, the contraction is a little bit unrealistic, I think. And sometimes I wonder if people like myself and people like you, we look at things through our lens. You know, we're prisoners of our own perspective, you know. We can't help but look at things in the way that we do. But when you really look at it from a sort of more simplistic, more black and white, this is what's in front of me perspective, I think then a very different picture emerges. And I think that in a lot of ways, I think, is what is the most dangerous about all of this. If we had have all been saving, and if we had have all just been very, very careful as a nation over the past few months, it'd be very different. That's not what's happened. People have gone out, they've blown their super on crap, used car sales have gone through the roof. And please, I am generalizing, I know. I'm not saying that everybody's done this, but on aggregate, if you look at where the money has gone, it's gone into gambling, it's gone into cars, it's gone into new TVs, they've been flying off the shelves. Those are all facts. But at the end of the day, it hasn't really done anything to help the economy. All it's done is postpone it, and it's just created more problems for the future. And when the adjustment does come, in a lot of ways, it's going to be worse. Because in the past, if we had have just got knocked off the horse, so to speak, when the crisis first came through back in March, it would have been like falling from up here. But now that we've got $100 billion extra flowing in the economy, another 16% more household income, we're falling from up here instead. And I think that's really part of the problem as well. I mean, you know, not to rant on or anything, but I feel like we could really just see a sort of shattering of that illusion around the economy. And I think that that's something that the government has to be very wary of going forward.
Yeah, well, I think you're right. We often agree on, you know, some of the fundamental points. And I guess the first point we should agree on is we're both nerds, and therefore we go deep into the data and probably have a different perspective and understanding compared with, you know, the average Australian. The second point is the government's been, preaching the gospel of everything's going to be fine. And, of course, they keep making the same announcements again and again and again to try and actually... Have you noticed how many times the same announcement comes out? It's just hilarious, right? and that's all about, you know, marketing perception. So there is a veneer of perception which is very much being propagated. It's being supported, of course, by both the regulators and indeed by the main banks. But you know, there is an economic reality below the surface. And I think the other thing I just want to sort of highlight is we know that JobKeeper has not been that effective in helping many people, right? I mean, it did help an American university. Did you notice that? So yeah, that's pretty cool. So no academics in Australia necessarily got help, but an American university was able to access JobKeeper. So how does that work? I mean, it's, you know, so it just shows you there's a little bit of weirdness going on in terms of some of the policy responses that they put out. And I think they should have done something. Personally, I think they should have done something more direct for households rather than via businesses. But, you know, it's too late to discuss that further now. But the reality is dawning. And I just look at those numbers and I think, well, okay. So there's been a lot of money floating in. Some of that's gone to savings, but a lot of it has not gone to savings. We've still got the very high debt levels. And we've still got now more mortgage holders being phoned up by the banks to say, okay, right, when are you going to start repaying your mortgages? I mean, for me, that's going to be a very, very significant shock. And I don't know whether you saw, but the Reserve Bank also put out a report in their bulletin looking specifically at the rental sector. And they were making the point that rents have actually dropped considerably, particularly close to the main urban centres. And that is a story that is not being fully understood yet. But of course, that has a significant impact on property investors as well as renters themselves. And now renters, of course, who had a repayment holiday, or did they? Was it a holiday or was it a deferral? We'll find out down the track. Some of those are now being turned off as well. So all of the levers are being flicked from support to lack of support. And what that means is that we are now confronting the really big critical change of momentum. And yet I think that households probably are less prepared than they were 6 months ago.
No, exactly. Like I've been thinking about it a lot lately. Like just seeing all these sort of extend and pretend things that the government, the various, you know, state, federal, and territory governments have been doing, and I look at the extension of the eviction moratoriums. Now, we've got this perspective from the banks saying, oh, property prices are going to start rising mid next year. They're going to be up 20% by 2023 on mid next year's numbers. And then I look at the eviction moratoriums, and I'm just like, okay, let's just war game this out for a second. Most of these now, for the vast majority of the Australian population, or a majority of the population, they're not going to be concluding until either later in the year or March next year. Which I think I would be surprised if more weren't extended, to be completely honest with you. We've already seen that in Vic and WA and I believe South Australia. And I wouldn't be surprised if it's extended again. So let's just war game for a moment. March next year, there are going to be God knows how many landlords who haven't had any rent for months and months, who are now going to have to take these people to a court or a tribunal or whatever mechanism the states decide to set up to address it. And how many of them, we don't know. How many people are going to have people who didn't pay enough rent who are now going to be forced to sell the property, or people who just haven't been paid any rent at all? And there are some dodgy people out there who are just like, oh, well, they can't evict me. I just ain't going to pay you. Deal with it. There's nothing you can do. Watch me. And there are people like that in society, unfortunately. So it just makes you think, well, how many of those are going to have to turn around in those next few months after this eviction ban ends? After they've finally got these people out of their house using the sheriff or the coppers or the courts or whatever it takes, we're going to then have to turn around and sell these properties, either because they've had enough of being a landlord. And frankly, I wouldn't blame them for a nanosecond. It's a very, very tough set of circumstances to be in. Or just the fact that there's no longer a financial incentive there for them, whether it's the lack of capital gains or it's the falling rents or any number of other things. So how many of those people are going to be selling in June, July, August next year, just when these bank economists are telling us that housing prices are going to start rising?
Well, I've always said, and I keep saying, if you're going to panic early, and I'm already seeing some property investors who've actually shed their properties, right, in the last couple of months. And it's interesting that some of those who are portfolio property investors, in other words, they've got multiple properties, they've actually gone through the process of figuring out which one to actually shed, and they've shed it. So it's already started, right? Now, my worry is that the more naive, less experienced property investor is probably not yet awake enough to understand that they should be doing a thorough review of their property portfolio, be it one property or multiple properties, against the backcloth that you've just argued. Because as you go through this into this year, over Christmas, New Year, and into next year, there is going to be a flood, I think, particularly of apartments. And I do think the apartment sector is the particularly worrisome one. I'm just seeing so much data that's seeing rents drop through the floor in and around apartments. Of course, a lot of them also have defects as well, and some of the strata fees are going up. The calculation about returns on property investment in units doesn't work. I can tell you that. I've done the math recently, right? And even if there was a little bit of property price recovery, then it would not work. But actually, we're seeing significant falls in values of those apartments. And actually, pretty much anybody who's in the market knows that there are significant areas in around our major urban areas where units have dropped. So there's no capital growth, there's no revenue stream, and yet you've still got a mortgage you've got to pay. And of course, those mortgage repayments are going to start up again sometime soon. So, you know, you can see the pressures on those property investors in my surveys. And as I say, the sassy ones are already acting. It's the less sassy ones who are actually sitting on the sidelines thinking, oh, it can't be that bad, you know, prices will go up. Everyone's saying the prices are going to go up next year. Well, you know, even if they do the maths, you probably won't be in a particularly good situation. And by the way, very few property investors have actually ever worked out what they paid for their property, including all the transaction costs, what all the running costs are, and then setting that off against the rent received and the mortgage repayments, right? If you put all that information into a calculator like the Nucleus Wealth Calculator, which does it really, really well, people are horrified when they actually do that to see what the overall negative return is without substantial capital growth. And that capital growth would have to be very, very significant to iron out the bumps over the last couple of years. So for me, probably investing is, I think, it's a sport whose time hasn't passed.
Well, I have to just disagree slightly. It's a bit just about where you manage to get the property and the price you manage to get it at. Hmm. Like I've known some people who they follow the mortgagee auctions. They're well connected with the agents. And so, I mean, I've known them getting properties 25, 30% below market value. Right. And there are, don't get me wrong, there are some bargains out there if you can find them. But by the same token, the idea of going to a seminar and being told that this new apartment is going to make you so stupendously wealthy, you know, along with everyone else in the room, is just, well, I'll let people make up their own mind. I won't say anything nasty, but you get the picture. And yep. I think the thing is that, like, one of the things I think is really interesting about this commentary about the housing market is that all this is going to be over really quickly. That mid next year, which realistically is only 9 months away, is going to be completely different to what it is now, when we're not going to see JobKeeper end until March at the earliest. And I think there's a very, very high likelihood that it's going to be extended beyond that in some way, shape, or form. And I think we will probably see an extension of the other measures as well. So I think that this is something that, like you made in the point to the investment bankers that you in your video yesterday, it's something that's going to be a longer, more protracted crisis. I mean, say, for example, you made the example of the property investors or the people who have deferred mortgages who are going to be coming out of these things in either September or March next year or sometime in between. Now, when you leave that, you're not immediately, you know, sort of in the crap, so to speak. You've still got to get 90 days in arrears again, and then you've got to go through all the bank's hardship provisions, and then there's all these other different things. I mean, so if you emerge from your mortgage, you know, your mortgage deferral in March next year, it's going to be the end of June before your 90 days in arrears anyway. And then it's going to be another 6, 9, 12 months before you've gone through all the various parts of the bank's hardship program. Depending on what bank you're with, it obviously it can vary quite drastically. So realistically, these people who want to hold on, you know, for dear life by their fingernails, they're not going to be selling their properties in a forced way if they get that extension until probably mid next year at the earliest. At the latest, it might even be mid sort of 2020, you know, early to mid 2022. And What does that say, once again, about these forecasts of prices rising and of this being a quick crisis? These people are going to be selling over time for years and years to come. So it seems to me, I mean, and perhaps I'm wrong, but it seems to me that our experience is going to be a lot closer in terms of these forced sales, in terms of things being a slow grind down. It's going to be a closer experience to sort of Ireland and the US than it's going to be to Australia circa 2009, where everything just magically took off again.
Well, I think you're spot on there, because in 2009, we never really had much of a wobble. We, of course, we had the China forces that really came in. We had the resource demand. And, of course, a couple of banks got support from the US to muddle through. And we really brushed it off. But remember that the income multiples were a lot lower then than now. So we've got more leverage to start with. We have a greater proportion of property investors than we had then. So that's also another factor. And the impact in terms of the property investor segment from the fact that rentals are being compressed dramatically wasn't there last time. So, and then the final point, that we actually had income starting to take off much more quickly. I think income growth is going to be pretty static this time too. So wherever you look, I think Ireland is a better analog, or maybe the UK or the US is a better analog, which suggests that this is a 2, 3, 4 year thing. And the other point to make is that the banks will not want to be heavy-handed with a lot of these people. They will probably try and encourage them to put the property on the market and sell in an ordered way, so that they don't necessarily have to go through foreclosure procedures and get all the bad press and publicity and everything else that follows from that. So I think that those conversations which are happening now to some sectors of the community with regard to the restarting their mortgages will be framed around, you know, it's probably best for you and it's best for us if you start to think about putting your property on the market. We'll give you a bit more leeway in the meantime, give you another 4 months to sort of work it through. But, you know, let's have a commitment from you that you're going to put the property on the market. So that's one of the reasons why I do believe that there will be more property listing. And in fact, Edwin just put a tweet out quite recently suggesting that he was starting now to see the first signs of that listing number rise. We'll see. It's early days. But of course, the listing numbers weren't as low through winter as perhaps sometimes. So that may be another signal. So I think it's, again, very complex, very difficult to see. But I do think Ireland is probably the best analogue.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I mean, at least sort of in terms of the data, in terms of the psychology, I have no idea what Australians are going to do. I'd like to think that I understand our collective psychology, but I don't think I do. I mean, I'm not entirely sure anybody does to a sort of very specific, definitive degree. But it is going to be interesting going forward just to see exactly what happens, because I've been looking at the sales turnover from Domain, and basically if you compare the current level of sales for this time of year with this quarter in the past, every single capital that I've looked at so far has fallen off a cliff.
Yep.
Compared with even 2018 when volumes were very, very low. Sales have absolutely plummeted to a huge degree. And I'm increasingly wondering if we're going to see some pent-up supply rather than pent-up demand, in the sense that if you look at the RBA's turnover rate for housing, it's been dropping fairly significantly for a long time now, more significantly from, say, 2016, 2017 until now. Now, part of that might be the fact that housing prices peaked in 2017 and people want to get back to the absolute top dollar value of their home before they sell. That could be part of it. But then there's also the other side of things. Unlike 2008, you know, we have a much older populace. We have a lot more demographic factors here going against the market. The average boomer today is around 65 or 66, compared with the average boomer being 52 or 53 during the financial crisis, which was the peak of their earnings, which was the time of, oh, there's all these grants to go build a new home. Let's go out to Whoop Whoop and buy a property and we're going to be rich. And all those various things supported the market then are now against the market now. So part of me does wonder that a lot of older people have been holding off on selling their properties now for a long time. And that's sort of evident in the turnover rates and even the very low sales volumes now. And I've noticed that I remember you mentioning even over the past, say, 18 months or so, that there's a lot of intention to transact from downsizers.
Yep.
And that hasn't really come through the figures yet. So part of me wonders if this continues, if we continue to see low volumes, if we're going to eventually hit a point where these older Australians who want to downsize, who want to move into, you know, assisted living or a retirement village or whatever it is, if they're just going to go, bugger it, I'm going to finally pull the trigger, I need to do this, I'm basically demographically compelled to sell.
Well, I can only report from my surveys what I'm seeing, which is that there is a consistent pattern now of down traders saying just that, and saying, well, if I'm going to sell, I should probably put the property on the market sooner rather than later, because essentially I want to try and protect as much equity as I can. I will need to sell over the next 2 or 3 years, and if prices are going to slide further, then do it sooner rather than later. And I guess the other point, or two other points to make, the first is in my surveys of SMEs, I can also look at JobKeeper by profession, including real estate agents, right? And there is a considerable representation of real estate agents on JobKeeper. That sort of revalidates the fact that the transaction throughput's very low. And of course, that's true both for renting and also for sales. And then the final point is the get out of jail card for the property market would have to be more migration, right? Because at the moment, the international borders are shut. And you'd have to be assuming, therefore, that those people who are forecasting a resurgence of the property market are basically intrinsically assuming all the borders will be open, international traffic will be back, and essentially, therefore, there'll be this external force coming in to try and actually buy up some of the very much oversupplied areas. I mean, there is just way too much. 1.2 million spare properties in Australia and growing. Buildings continuing to be thrown up at the moment, left, right and centre, even now. So, is that realistic? Well, the airlines are suggesting that the traffic won't be back for the next 2 years or so. So I think it's highly unlikely that we're going to see massive amounts of migration next year. I'm not sure that students are coming back. That was a very big component in the rental sector. So that's another reason why the rental sector is going to be stuck. So you know, if you start pulling it apart and just thinking about what those moving elements are, I can give you all the reasons why I think prices are going to slide. I really can't give you any reasons as to why prices might go higher. Frankly, even if they cut rates a bit more, it's hardly going to make any difference because we're right at rock bottom now. So, you know, that's why I think there is still more likelihood of a correction of some sort. Ireland probably, you know, is the shape of it, which tells you that it's going to be long and painful. And I think we have yet to really wake up to see what it is going to look like.
No, you're right. We realistically don't know. It's really real. I mean, as we've basically been the underlying theme of the show, it's extremely difficult to anticipate exactly what's going to happen in the coming months and years. I mean, I remember you saying recently that it could cost $850 billion to basically bail out housing prices in this country. And I'm just thinking to myself, well, he might do it. I'm not sure, you know, it's a low likelihood, but maybe he will. You know, it's a really sort of tough one to quantify, I think. And that's just really it, isn't it, in all of this? And I really do feel for people looking for properties right now. You know, they're making a choice on the concern that prices might rise. And I can completely as someone who isn't a homeowner myself, I can completely understand that. You know, there really is that sort of, it is almost a primal fear that somehow Scotty's going to find a way to pull some capital gains for property investors out of his hat, and that he's going to screw us all again. But I mean, I suppose everyone just needs to look at things, to assess their own situation, as you always say, and just cautiously make their own decision.
Yeah, I think you have to make your own decision, and there will be reasons why people will buy. So if you're an owner-occupier and you're buying, you know, an A-class asset for the reason of long-term occupation, then you know, there's probably still some reasons why it makes sense. If you're thinking of it from a property investment standpoint, unless, as you say, you buy real cheap, and hold it, I can't see how you can possibly justify a property investment. But then most property investors don't do the math. Most property investors will have gone to those seminars and then will have just piled in, you know, one property, then cross leverage to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. Look, I got 20 properties. Aren't I clever? Yeah, just look at how much debt you've got and look how much at risk you are if prices go the wrong way. You know, the fact is that people are being led by the nose into the property investment arena. And of course, it's all to the benefit of the building and construction sector, plus the real estate sector, plus the banks. So you can understand why everybody wants to preach this gospel. But, you know, what we're trying to do here, I guess, Tariq, is just lay out some of the counter arguments so that hopefully people can make better decisions by being able to sort of compare and contrast the different points of view out there. But, you know, I wonder what proportion of the population does any work on this. And most people will probably be at the beach and just say, oh, she'll be right.
Well, that's the Australian way. that's just the way it is. I mean, I think all we need to do is look at the way how successful Scott Morrison is with his various announcements about the economy. I mean, he's got a 91% approval rating amongst Liberal voters. He's got a 65% approval rating amongst voters more broadly. And he's not exactly the most likable bloke in the universe. I mean, he was coming off a horrible, horrible approval rating during the bushfires. So he started off from a really low base. But I think that's just emblematic of how much people want to believe. You know, I'm not sure if you've seen the X-Files, but there's that poster in Mulder's office with the picture of the flying saucer that says, I want to believe. We should have one behind Scott Morrison that's just of a housing price, you know, graph just consistently rising that just says, I want to believe. You know, just that somehow, some way, things are going to get better. And I just back to your point on immigration for a moment. I mean, is it possible that they do it? Sure. It's possible that they could throw open the floodgates and they could napalm whatever chances they had, and Pauline Hanson will take control, will take a massive amount of control in the Senate if they try and pull that, and hell, Labor might even get their stuff together and really give them a run for their money. But realistically, if the sort of, you know, if the say for example the graph I sent you from UBS, if that is correct, and I tend to believe that it is, you know, sort of unemployment now sitting around about 10%, further downside with the tapering of JobKeeper, and then further downside again with the end of JobKeeper. If you put all that together with what we've got, increasing immigration is just the dumbest idea in the universe. Mm. Well, maybe not the dumbest, but it's up there, you know. It's, you know, I mean, it's not quite Major Kong riding the bomb in Doctor Strangelove, but it's pretty stupid. I mean, every person that we bring in who's doing it, you know, a sort of normal everyday job is one more job that we need to create to get Australia back to full employment. And I really, really hope they don't go down that road. I really hope that there's that political pressure on them not to do it. Although, I mean, we're just going to have to wait to see.
Well, you know, the bottom line is this. We know that the Australian economy is digging stuff out of the ground and flogging it overseas. It's putting more and more money into ever-inflated housing, and it's inflating the economy by bringing more people in. That's been the rule of the game for at least two decades. I have seen nothing yet to suggest that any of those rules are changing. So unless the budget in a couple of weeks marks us in a new direction, I wouldn't be surprised to see more of the same old, but whether it'll be successful, you and I will have to come back and talk about it down the track.
Yeah, well, it honestly, if ScoMo was actually going to do something major and different in the budget, in about, what, 5 to 10 days' time, there's going to be a ticker tape parade, you know, around Parliament House with all sorts of floats and animals and all sorts of things to celebrate his achievement. But I highly doubt it. I think it's going to be the gas-fired recovery, and it's going to be industrial relations reform and tax cuts for the wealthy, and that's what we're going to do because that's what we say works, and that's what we have to do.
Yeah, I think you're right. I'm afraid it's going to be a replay of the last 10 years rather than actually setting out in a new direction. But we could be proved wrong. We'll know in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, hopefully we're wrong about the whole thing with the budget, and we're right about the housing prices, because I think there's quite a few viewers out there who would like to be able to buy a house at a globally affordable price.
Well, yeah, I mean, that is the bottom line, isn't it? Right, and it's just worth reflecting on that as we close, Tariq, that housing affordability has never been more adverse than it is now. More people are renting than owning property. It's taking much more effort to save to be able to get into the market. And frankly, if you replay this forward without some major intervention and major transformation and change, housing affordability will just continually force people away from buying property, when in fact, of course, many people would love to be able to get in at the right price. So there is actually a silver lining to all of this. If we actually do have a bit of a down move in prices and we begin to move back to a more affordable environment, actually, long term, the economy and those people wanting to get into property could well benefit.
Well, absolutely. I mean, all you got to do is look at the Bank of International Settlements, the household debt service ratio. Yep. You know, we spend almost one in every $6 that Australians earn on servicing our debts, and almost all of which flows to mortgages.
Right. And remember that that's 1/3 of the population. Yeah. Right. So 2/3 either rent or actually have property home free, right? So that's where the debt is concentrated, which is why we are so sensitized to any changes in the housing market. Interesting conversations today, Tariq. Thank you very much once again. I look forward to picking up again next time.
Yeah, me too, mate. I'll catch you later.
See you later.